With less than 5% of the planet's population, the United States houses 22% of the world's prisoners. The challenges of navigating that system don't end when the convicted felon completes his or her sentence. Today's guest shines a light on the substantial barriers felons face when they try to re-enter society. She's Keisha Middlemass, this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, artists, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Keisha Middlemass, an associate professor of public policy in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. Dr. Middlemass is also an award-winning author of an important book about the American criminal justice system. It's titled Convicted and Condemned, The Politics and Policies of Prisoner Reentry. Keisha, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to talk to you about your book, but we also want to talk a little bit about the challenges in the American criminal justice system. How big an issue are we talking about? How many people are in prison and how many people are coming out each year?
Right. So currently there's approximately 1.1 million people either in state and federal prisons and local jails. And that number, of course, fluctuates because people are going in and out all the time. And then in terms of individuals coming out of prison every year, it ranges between 650,000 to 750,000 people every single year that are released from prison. And that number then, of course, multiplies if you think about all those other people that were released a year ago and those that were released 2 years ago. So you're talking about millions of people in the United States living in multiple different types of communities that have prison experience in their background.
How does that compare globally? How does the United States, in terms of its prison population and its former prisoners, how do we compare to the rest of the world?
It is so far worse than other countries. The United States outpaces in terms of incarceration rates, in terms of the use of prison for multiple social issues.
What do you mean by that?
So we use now prison for mental health. We don't have mental health institutions that were shut down largely in the late 70s and early 1980s, and now we incarcerate individuals with mental illnesses. And so when you start thinking about mental illness as a public policy issue, we now use the criminal justice system to incarcerate people that are ill.
And there's precious little mental health therapy and treatment in most prisons. I think that's a true
yes.
statement.
Common across all state and federal prisons. In fact, one of my participants repeatedly said, no one's getting rehabbed.
And not only are people not getting rehab, and again, we're talking about people living with mental illness, they're not getting better or in any way. They're, in many cases, decompensating or becoming worse in terms of their mental status.
Yes, totally. Even those that would not be diagnosed with a mental illness before they went inside prison would come out with trauma. There's a lot of sociologists and psychologists now looking at PTSD as prison-induced PTSD. As that it is traumatizing to be locked up in overcrowded, unsanitary conditions for years.
So, I mean, two sort of huge questions, right?
Yes.
Among many others.
So,
yes.
So why does the United States incarcerate so many of its citizens? And why are the prisons in the condition that they're in?
So to your first question, why incarcerate? The United States has a long history of using punishment, incarceration, as a form of addressing anybody that violates the social norms. And unfortunately, that then accelerated underneath Democratic and Republican presidents from Nixon onwards, you start thinking about the war on drugs and the policies that then were implemented due to the war on drugs. And then you start thinking about drug use. So we talked just a bit ago about mental illness, but we also then incarcerate individuals that are addicted. And so the United States leads the world in incarceration rates, and the use of prisons became a policy position of legislators, state and federal, of not wanting to be accused of being soft on crime. Like this whole idea of I'm tough on crime, let's make it harder for individuals when they go inside because prison is punishment.
Right.
And then that accelerated in the 1990s and 2000s with a set of policies that then targeted individuals when they were released from prison. And I'm not talking about parole and probation. I'm talking outside of the criminal justice system.
So talk about conditions inside prisons. I mean, there has been, and I guess there probably still is in some circles, a narrative that it's a country club experience and you go in and blah, 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 blah. What's the reality? It certainly is not a country club.
Right. So there are a handful of federal prisons that are low security, nonviolent offenders. So there's not the same type of walls and then fencing and then more fencing. And so there are a few federal prisons that are country club-ish when you're thinking about prison.
Yeah.
But the idea of prisons most oftentimes is the states don't invest in rebuilding new prisons. So a lot of prisons in this country are 60, 70, 80 years old. And so you're literally using keys to unlock doors. And so these cells are small. The ventilation is not good. And because of the punishment and the idea of punishing, you then don't have a lot of good food. You don't have vegetables. You start thinking about the idea of your eyesight decreasing the more time you spend inside because of bad and poor lighting. You start thinking about the lack of exercise. And then there's overcrowding. And Oklahoma just released almost 500 low nonviolent offenders, or low in terms of their crime. So nonviolent offenders, they were just released. And the idea was like, well, we have to reduce the incarceration rate. We have to reduce the number of people incarcerated. And a lot of people don't know that incarceration in of itself is harmful. And then there's harm when men and women come out.
So if we can, in very broad brushstrokes, describe who goes to prison in the United States.
There are segments of every sector of the population have served time. So when you think about socioeconomic status, when you think about race, when you think about gender, there's more studies on transgender individuals going to prison and where should they be incarcerated and should they be able to continue their health care and hormone regimen, depending on where they are incarcerated. But for the most part in this country, we incarcerate poor people and we incarcerate Black people. And unfortunately, Latinos are increasing in terms of percentages. And the fastest growing group of individuals now going to prison are Black women.
Wow. You talked about lack of investment in prisons. And that's been a chronic issue. And it's very hard to get public support, really just for basic funding of prisons. I'm talking now at the state level, state by state by state. Never mind the costs for building new prisons. Why is it so hard to get the public behind that? I mean, if you think about this rationally, and if you're in your field and have done the work you've done, it makes all kinds of sense to invest.
Yes.
And not just physical structures, but programs and so forth.
The economic impact of prisons is huge when you start thinking about state budgets. So most of my research was done in New Jersey. New Jersey spends approximately $1 billion a year on the criminal justice system, broadly defined. And when you're spending that kind of money, that means it's not going into roads, if anybody's been to Jersey. It's not going into it's not going into education. It's not going into public health. It's not going into programs. But the big part is the investment is in warehousing individuals. Now, part of the challenge is, how do you convince people then to reduce the dollars they spend on prison? Because then the fear of the public, and I'm thinking about voters, is they'll be like, oh, you're releasing all these bad people back into the community. We don't want them to be back in the community. And no one really talks about dollars and cents. So on average, and this is nationally, some states are a little bit more expensive, but it's about $30,000, $35,000 a year to incarcerate one person. Whoa. Right. You can get a four-year degree at a state institution for $35,000. Most states.
So we want to talk about the book, but the one question that sort of lingers in my mind, I'm old enough to remember a time when there was a conversation about rehabilitation in America's prisons.
Yes.
That's not really a conversation you hear anymore. Are there any programs in place in prisons to help set people up for when they get out?
So you have to think about, when individuals come out, you got to think about the whole person. So when you start thinking about programs inside, you have to think about healthcare. I have interviewed individuals that would have broken their arm inside and it's not treated for a couple of weeks. And then it's put into a cast, but it doesn't heal properly. So their arm is literally bent. So you start thinking about just general healthcare. Then you start thinking about the diseases that are rampant inside. TB, you also have to think about diabetes and heart disease, lack of being able to exercise, and then poor diet. So you think about all those diseases. You also have to then think about education. So early 1990s, the Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson from Texas was an individual that proposed taking Pell Grants away from prisoners. And the idea was Pell Grants that were going towards prisoners were being then money not spent on good students. And the fact is if you're eligible for a Pell Grant, you don't take the money away from somebody else. The federal government just pays up to who's eligible and to the max amount. And then more laws were passed after that first taking away Pell Grants. More laws were passed that if you had a felony conviction and you were outside of prison, you couldn't then get Pell Grants. And if you're poor and we're incarcerating poor people, the best way you can pay for education is through Pell Grants. So there's healthcare, there's education, then you start thinking about housing. There's a whole bunch of laws passed under President Clinton that prevented individuals with a felony conviction and with even in some states an arrest record to live in public housing. So if you are poor, you can't even, let's say if your family lives in public housing, you then cannot go back and live with your family. There are Supreme Court cases that have approved the eviction of grandmothers who had taken in a grandchild with a felony conviction. And because she had offered housing, she was evicted from public housing. So now you're starting to think about the whole person. And then we don't deal with mental health. And so then individuals leave prison unprepared. Back to the specific question about programming. Some universities will do volunteer, literally faculty will volunteer.
Right.
And they will do what is known as inside-out programs. So they'll have small classes, take their students from the university to the prison and teach class. A lot of universities have then created systems to be able to allow those inside students to actually get credit. Great system. But then there's all these contradictions. California, with the wildfires, there was this great article on CNN just probably about a few days ago. If you're incarcerated in California, you can volunteer to go to what is known as a fire camp. You are trained by California EMT, or not EMT, but California Fire. Yes, Cal Fire. I was thinking about all the initials, what they stand for. Cal Fire would train you as a prisoner to fight fires. You are trained underneath their rules. Yes, you are watched by prison guards, but you're trained under Cal Fire's rules. When you exit prison, you are not allowed to work for Cal Fire because you have a felony conviction.
I mean, that's just crazy.
So let's segue into the book.
No, it makes no sense.
Zero sense.
Zero sense.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books, including the recently published Kid Number One. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is a remarkably talented scholar. Dr. Keisha Middlemass is an associate professor of public policy in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. She's the recipient, too, of the W.E.B. Du Bois Distinguished Book Award for Convicted and Condemned, The Politics and Policies of Prisoner Reentry. The book is Convicted and Condemned, The Politics and Policies of Prisoner Reentry, and it's the winner of the W.E.B. Du Bois Distinguished Book Award from the National Conference of Black Political Scientists in 2018.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, you know, the one of the central arguments of the book seems to be that a felony conviction in the United States today is essentially a life sentence.
It is.
Unpack that for us.
So, through various policies passed by Congress, we now have what is almost like a national database of individuals with a felony conviction. You, even as a private citizen, if you have a credit card and want to spend $25 or $30, can do a background check on an individual and see if they have a criminal history. When you start taking that aspect of being able to do a quick criminal history search, now that felony conviction doesn't just follow the person home, but it follows them to their first job. Most jobs now, low level, high level, do a criminal background check. You now struggle to be able to get grants to go to university, or universities may not allow you to go to university because they will actually ask you on forms, do you have a felony conviction? That's a whole nother challenge. You also then have to think about housing. Where do you live when you're poor in this country? Generally, it used to be public housing. But policies have now rolled back accessing public housing. We as a society no longer build traditional public housing. We've moved to a voucher system, Section 8 vouchers. But now those vouchers are used on the private market, and those landlords can do a criminal background check and deny someone. So you've got multiple laws that are outside of the criminal justice system that follow an individual in all areas of their life that restrict them from being able to access public benefits, even traditional welfare benefits.
So you're talking about the individual who is a felon.
Yes.
There's another big piece of this, which is very important, which is the family. The
yes.
family members, the children, the parents, the siblings, the relatives of people who are incarcerated. There's a
right.
huge cost, both in terms of the time mm-hmm. people are away, mm-hmm. behind bars, and also reentry. Talk about
right.
that, because this is, it's a huge problem.
Right. So traditionally, reentry has been thought of, prisoner reentry has been thought of as an urban problem. So big cities, we have lots of people from very particular neighborhoods, and GIS mapping is now doing this more and more frequently, is individuals from certain neighborhoods go into prison and then go back to that neighborhood. So now you've got a concentrated core urban community with over 20 or 25% of the population with a felony conviction. Now we're also moving into this area of rural reentry, where urban cities may have resources, but there are rural populations that are now returning to states with maybe like one major city, but let's say your family can house you 2 hours away. You can't get your driver's license. You don't have money for gas. You can't drive a car. How do you get to those services? So now there's more and more research on rural reentry and the challenges of rural reentry. But what we have is these pockets of prisoner reentry unfolding in very distinct neighborhoods. And that then becomes the concentrated problem and challenges of if you have a high percentage of people that cannot get a job, talking about families, the disconnect between individuals that have been away and then they come back and their children are older. How do you do family reunification? In multiple instances of doing interviews, individuals have, their parents have died while they were locked up. Staying with their grandmother, their siblings don't want anything to do with their loved one that was locked up, because let's say the sibling now has gotten a good job or gotten married and now has a spouse that sort of like, I don't want to deal with parole and them invading our home. So there's lots of family issues that go into when someone does come home.
So what happens to these folks? They've paid their debt to society.
Supposedly.
All right, and then they're now they're being placed back out on the street. What happens to them?
Unfortunately, it's not good. So this country has probably around 25 or 30 years consistently, 67% of those individuals that are released from prison go back to prison within 3 years.
This is recidivism.
This is recidivism, right. Exactly.
Repeat offenders.
Yeah. Repeat offenders, they fail to re-enter for multiple reasons. Sometimes it's parole violations, probation violations, a new crime. Sometimes it's because they have violated parole because they could not get a job.
But the system is just totally.
But the system with the criminal background check says, no, I'm not going to hire a felon. And then parole will have been like, oh, okay, well, you can't get a job. I can now revoke you and you got to go back.
What about the front end of the system, as it were, before going to prison? So many people are incarcerated for relatively minor drug offenses, possession, minor sales of drugs. Are there programs anywhere that are working in diverting people from prison and addressing the core issue there, which may be drug use and abuse?
So in my experience doing interviews, that the knowledge of the street was that even if you never used drugs, but you sold drugs, you said you used drugs and there's lots of programs for you. But if you just sell drugs as an economic engine, but you never used, there are no programs. What's the program? They have to be employed. They got to be educated. They have to be trained. They go to vocational school. The lack of job opportunities is the problem. But how do you fix that when you start thinking about you sold drugs, you've never used drugs, oh, and you had a gun, so now you get an extra 5 years. I was just trying to think, what's the policy to fix that, where there are programs if you're a drug addict?
So people who are addicted or with addiction issues who are incarcerated, this is certainly the case in stories that I've written and read, you do your time, you're released. You get your clothes, you're put up front, bus stop. And if you have an addiction issue, what's the first thing you want to do?
Get high.
Score.
Get high. And so how can you expect without some program at that point to have success?
Remember,
I mean, this is a disease, and that's another issue that we could do a whole show on, the stigma of that particular disease.
Right.
But there's nothing in
there's
most places.
There's AA or NA at the homeless shelter.
That's it.
Yeah.
If families are wealthy, that's the real, if your family's wealthy, but in every aspect in American life, if your family's wealthy,
you're better off.
You're better off.
So one of the terms that I was introduced to in reading your book is the idea of social disability.
Yes.
And you describe folks with a felony conviction experience social disability. Explain that to our audience.
Of course. Thank you for the question. So when we think about disability in a broad sense, society has changed, particularly since the Americans with Disability Act was passed in 1990. We now have wider doors. We now have disability access in terms of bathrooms. We have bars. We have wide sidewalks. We've got, there's now this new effort to put where blind people live, to put bumped, raised, bright yellow, I don't think it's cement, but probably plastic within the sidewalk. So then they come across that with their cane and they're like, oh, I know it, I'm at an intersection. We have made lots and lots of lots and lots of changes to be able to allow individuals with physical and mental disabilities, emotional disabilities, to be able to access public spaces, go to university, move around as they see fit. That only came with, of course, a lot of social activism, lobbying, and parents advocating for their children to be able to access spaces. In terms of if you're disabled and there's no curb ramp, how do you get around if you're in a wheelchair? If you are blind, how do you then navigate spaces if that yellow block of textured rippling in the sidewalk doesn't tell you there's an intersection? So when I argue that individuals with a felony conviction are socially disabled, we have created laws, the social aspect, that have disabled them from accessing public spaces, be it jobs, educational opportunities, being able to visit their family and loved ones in public housing, being able to actually then re-enter successfully and not go back to prison.
So understanding that we have a federal prison system, and then we have a state-by-state prison system, what kind of political will or change will it take to adopt policies to correct this, to treat incarcerated people as people who are coming back into society, and let's give them some help?
Yeah, so the political lift will have to be enormous. Right now, politicians at the state and federal level are really addressing the low-hanging fruit. So let's do de-incarceration. Let's allow individuals to get out early. But they still have a felony conviction on the record. Let's use diversionary programs like drug courts. Well, that's a good effort, but there's such a small set of, I don't even know what the word would be, but there's a small set of people that actually have thought critically about how to change the current system, but have not figured out the politics of it. So we may not hear about being tough on crime, but no politician wants to be told they're soft on crime. And how do you then navigate that 2-second soft on crime when the politics are what it is?
And the narrative in American culture is what it is.
Exactly.
10 seconds. How's this? Is any prospect for change in the current political environment?
Maybe.
We'll leave it at that.
That's actually a good answer.
We will leave it at that. Keisha Middlemass, thank you so much. The book is Convicted and Condemned. It's an important read. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit PellCenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.